The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Predictable times at the top of the Premier League, the top two winning again and the four below them refusing to take this thing seriously. United and Chelsea draw, Arsenal get tonked in Leicester and Spurs send a message to Ajax by losing at home to West Ham. At the bottom it's looking bleak for Cardiff while Norwich and Sheffield United confirm promotion to the promised land of parking the bus for a year while Bielsa orders his players to let Villa score. In Europe, Dortmund slip up and then Bayern slip up to keep it interesting. Barca win La Liga and PSG lose the cup final. We'll do all that. Take your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, you said you'd get up at 3 in the morning to watch Game of Thrones Line of Duty, do your work, and be here for an 8 a.m. start. Did you do all those things?
I didn't. No, I set my alarm for 4 and it went off and I just couldn't get out of bed.
Okay, so just to be clear on spoilers, there should be no mention of Game of Thrones or Line of Duty?
I've seen Line of Duty.
Okay, fine. But still, you don't want spoilers because you're a good man.
Yes.
Okay. Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max.
Denim John says, thank goodness for Lars. The only one who won't take long pauses, Barry, or sudden stops, John Bruin, mid-sentence. You're here for the flow here, Lars.
I guess, but I'm now very tempted to do both just as an act of contrarianism.
But your quirk is to sometimes sound like someone's put a rubber duck up your nose.
Yeah, that came back the other week for some reason, which is I have a surprisingly squeaky voice occasionally.
Have you been to see anybody about that?
No.
Okay. Maybe you should. I mean, or at least Google it. John Bruin, how are you? Insulted before you even got to speak.
I'm well.
Excellent news. Should we start then with the sort of non-race for the top four? A few people tweeting in saying it just shows how prestigious the Everton Cup is now that Manchester United, Chelsea, Arsenal and Spurs all want to finish seventh. At Old Trafford, United won, Chelsea won. Was this a good game or a bad game? I just couldn't work out if it was...
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So that would suggest it was a good game. I thought a draw was probably the fair result. Manchester United played reasonably well, better I think in the first half until they conceded that equaliser, is probably as well as they've played under Ollie, and so that was a good portent for the future, particularly in light of their recent bad run. And you know, you worry about David De Gea because you know that's his third Rick in 4 games. Mm-hmm. What do you do with him now? Do you take him out of the firing line and perhaps shatter what remaining confidence he has left? Or do you leave him there to play out the last two games and possibly throw in another one? It's something I suppose he and Solskjaer will have to talk about.
Up to Joe had that, yeah. He's made 3 errors leading to goals in the last 4 games in all competitions for Manchester United, as many in his previous 123 matches combined for them. I mean, the point is, John, surely you do have to drop him, because otherwise there's no point in having a reserve goalkeeper. You know, there's no you've got to feel like your place is under threat, don't you?
Yeah, Sergio Romero is probably the best goalkeeper, the reserve goalkeeper in the Premier League. I mean, he's played, Lars will know this, 70-odd times for Argentina. He's never actually let United down when he's played. If we're to talk about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as essentially following the doctrines of Sir Alex Ferguson, I thought back about this. Now, none other than Peter Schmeichel had a bad patch during the treble season, 98-99, and he was packed off on holiday to Portugal.
Well, that's nice.
For a couple of weeks or 10 days or so, where actually he did decide that he was going to leave the club at the end of the season, which may not be such a good portent for Manchester United, but I think we can say that Schmeichel came through that season, and sometimes you have to take a goalkeeper out of the firing line. And if Ollie is on his usual hotline to Sir Alex, you would have thought that was the advice. The big difference, of course, is there's only 2 games left, as Barry says.
96 appearances for Argentina, Sergio Romero.
Yeah, and that's more than he's played in club football in the last 6 or 7 years. Yeah.
You wonder if there's an element of sort of club politics going on there with the situation, is they're trying to convince De Gea to sign a new contract, and sort of dropping him right before the end of the season might not be the way to do that. But you're right, it's strange. I kind of disagree. I didn't think this was a very good game. I thought there was a game between a team in Chelsea who have a type of football they want to play that they're currently not succeeding at playing. And Man United, which is kind of like a weird formless blob at the moment. Like, I'm not quite sure what they're trying to do. It was a bit ill-tempered. That's always fun. You had sort of Azpilicueta being sent into a photographer on the sideline, always good sort of physical comedy, and just kind of being slapped in the face. And then Marcos Rojo should have been sent off. So there was all that going on. But in terms of quality, I didn't think it was very good. And I thought, we talk about no one wanting the Champions League. Tottenham, Chelsea, Arsenal and Man United, in their last three games, all of these teams have one win between them, right? And that's not just because the Premier League is mad competitive. It's because they're all sort of quite flawed in different ways.
Just finally on De Gea, he did make a very important save that wasn't really made a lot of in the final minute from Gonzalo Higuain.
Yeah, he did. But he's clearly out of form. But yeah, he did make a good save.
That was such a strange incident, because it was as if Gonzalo Higuain was surprised to be onside, and you could see why that would be after his afternoon's work.
He was offside five times, as producer Jonathan says. Impressive for someone so slow.
Yeah. I think Lukaku was giving him a run for his money on that one. And De Gea also looked surprised to make the save. And that probably represents, in a microcosm, that game, which was, I sort of agree with Lars, a fairly shapeless mess. Mm. Not a good advertisement for the Barclays.
For the best league in the world. Juan Mata scored, didn't he, on his 31st birthday, fourth player to score on their birthday in the Premier League this season. And it was a lovely goal. And actually, I tend to agree with you, Barry. They played very well in the first half, I thought, Manchester United. Gary says, who was the lumpiest player on the pitch? Shaw, Higuain, Sanchez when he came on.
Lumpiest?
I think he means sort of the one who's carrying a little bit.
Well, I think Romelu Lukaku is carrying, and not, he's not fat, but I think he's too heavy, he's too muscular, and it's slowing him down.
Okay. Any advances on that?
I think of that, the other three are, let's say, beefy. Mm. Well, yes, Sanchez, there's a player to me, and I tweeted about this yesterday and got a response. He looks like he's forgotten how to play football. There were various points where the ball would come to him and you could see his thought process would be that of me put onto the Old Trafford pitch. He just didn't seem to know what was going on.
And he was such a, like at Arsenal, it was just so natural for him,
exactly,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I think people have forgotten quite how good he was there.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a certain point, probably about 2014, where he was probably in the top 10 players in the world. I said yesterday, I think he was probably not in the top 250. I'd probably move that back a bit and say top 350, 450. Just to point on Lukaku, actually, there was that header by Marcus Rocco, who shouldn't have been on the pitch at the time. Why did Lukaku duck that header when...
That's coming really quickly.
But if that's Alan Shearer, he's going to nod that at goal.
Maybe. I think when it's super slow mode, I think it makes you think Lukaku's got more time there. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt there. I think that's coming so fast.
Okay, fair enough.
But I mean, look, I'm speaking as a bad amateur footballer. Lars.
Just on Higuain, I mean, Chelsea, we mentioned it when he went there. Chelsea have a long and proud history of signing previously brilliant forwards who are just on the turn a little bit. Looking back at like Shevchenko and even Eto'o when he was there, and you can say that was the situation with Torres, even though he was younger. I mean, throughout the Abramovich era, that's been their thing. They signed strikers just a couple of years too late. And with the best will in the world, like looking at Higuain, it looks like this is the case again, because it's the whole we joke about him.
Happened to Chris Sutton as well, didn't
he? We joke about him not moving around, but he really isn't moving very much around, is he? It's very strange.
Chris Sutton was 10 million at a time when 10 million was 10 million.
So, I mean, if you are an established centre-forward, don't go to Stamford Bridge would be the lesson.
Or maybe when they come to get you, that's a bad sign. Like that's.
Was Matic lucky to stay on the pitch? We all think Rocco should have got a red card. Matic sort of left
Eric
his elbow.
Bailly should have got one as well, shouldn't he?
He flew in as well, didn't he? Got injured as well.
I thought the Matic, if you're referring to the arm to the face, I thought that was more reckless than malicious and violent, to be honest. It was more like a flinging of the arm rather than an attempt.
Does that make a difference? Is that?
I think it does with regards to the letter of the law. I think it's if you're going to send him off, it has to be either for violent conduct or for endangering opponent. I don't think he's endangering an opponent, really, by flinging the arm there. And I also don't think he's trying to strike him. I think he's being reckless in his, which is a yellow card. If I'm not,
Ian said, in the panel's opinion, under what circumstances should Manchester United really go for it and appoint a Keane Neville managerial dream team?
When hell freezes over. I mean, okay, this Keane Neville idea is this idea of, and they've actually attempted it with Solskjaer already. This keeper of the United flame, and I think. There are Manchester United fans of a certain age that enjoyed that time when Roy Keane went around the pitch bollocking everybody, screaming and thinking that that would be the person that they'd like to be on the pitch, and United won. So they just want to go back to that era when, in the modern era, it's just not possible. Roy Keane is a fantastic pundit, once in a while, actually. I'm not sure that anything in his managerial career or even Gary Neville's managerial career points to that being an anyway credible idea.
I think Manchester United do really need a Roy Keane-type figure in the dressing room, but they just don't need Roy Keane to be that Roy Keane-type figure.
He was at the Republic of Ireland when players were going on the pitch and didn't know what position they were playing in on the pitch. And I mean, Martin O'Neill was in charge.
He began his managerial career well. He marched Sunderland. He took over Sunderland when they were, I think, bottom of the Championship and march them out as champions, but everything he's done since has been pretty disastrous.
Before the game, Maurizio Sarri pledged to transform Chelsea into title contenders if he's given 2 years. Anyone reckon he'll be given that? Lars, speak for all of us.
I don't really think so, but then you don't really know what's going on in Chelsea. It's really hard to predict how Chelsea are going to behave, because you wonder about the owner, like how invested he is in the whole thing, halfway pun intended, I guess. There's this looming transfer ban that might affect how, because we don't, since Abramovich bought the club, the trend has been that they either win the league or sack the manager. Like, there's only 2 years where there's an exception to that rule. So you would say a hard no, of course he won't get time because it's Chelsea, don't be crazy. But right now, things are in a state of flux at Chelsea, and we honestly, it's hard to predict how they're going to behave. So I honestly don't know. But I do wonder if this transfer ban comes in and they have to make do with players being brought back from loan, with some of these really good youth players they have who never get a game. Is Sarri the right guy to do that? Because he doesn't seem to trust young players very much, and he is a football ideologue. It's very much his way or no way at all. And I wonder if the transfer ban happens, there's a time coming where maybe more pragmatism is needed at the wheel at Chelsea, and Sarri certainly is not a pragmatist.
Right, that result is certainly better for Chelsea. They have the nobody wants it fourth place at the moment, 68 points. Manchester United on 65. Chelsea, the much better goal difference. Spurs, the only one of these sides to have a win next to them in the last three games. That one last week against Brighton. They lost at home to West Ham, Barry. Their first defeat at the new stadium. Mikel Antonio with the first opposition goal at the new stadium. Lovely goal it was too. Slightly terrifying celebration from him. But West Ham deserved that win, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Spurs look very tired, very leggy. I think I'm concerned about how they're going to fare against Ajax. On the evidence of recent performances, you know, I don't think you can fault them for effort. They're just knackered, and that, you know, their squad limitations are being exposed. But yeah, hats off to West Ham. They thoroughly deserve that win, I thought. Created more chances, and it's nice, I suppose, for Mikel Antonio, who seems like a great bloke. Yeah. Worrying celebrations aside, that it's a nice little record to have the first visiting player to score at that new stadium.
The celebration is a sort of riding a horse without a horse. It's quite thrusty. Mikhail said, there's a guy on Instagram, Dan Roo, that does crazy dance moves. I saw it the other day. I've been busting it out in a couple of clubs, so time to bring it out on the pitch. It lets me show my personality. Ross says, how does everyone feel about Antonio's celebration in super slow-mo?
I like it.
Do you?
Okay. Well, you know, if you're going to be the first opponent to score at the new stadium, I mean, that's a goal for the history books. You've got to do something memorable with the celebration. And he did.
He does have quite a nice line in goal celebrations. You know, there was his Homer Simpson one, and then more recently he sort of snuggled up to the new AstroTurf around the edge of the pitch at the Olympic Stadium. So, you know, it's nice that he puts a bit of thought into them.
That But when he says, I've been doing it in clubs and he only saw it the other week, how many clubs is he going to?
I have no idea.
He
doesn't go to any of the clubs I regularly hang out in. I haven't seen him.
Nor do anyone else.
When were you last in a nightclub, John?
That's a great question. I do remember. I went to... I was with Miguel Delaney, of course, in the Fez Bar in Putney, and it was absolutely bloody awful.
The thing is, there will be the young people who listen to this podcast who go to nightclubs, and it's just important to say, as men of experience now, you're never going to get what you want to get. It's never inside there. Whenever you're queuing up and you're thinking, what's inside there is what I need, it isn't. Just go home and go to bed. West Ham fans are very upset, Lars, that none of the mainstream broadcasters are crucifying Heung-min Son for his evil stamp on Robert Snodgrass. Do you give him the benefit of the doubt? Because he's not that kind of player, Lars.
I mean, it didn't look nice. He's a footballer who did a stamp. It happens. What do you mean? I mean, we don't have a cross in here, nor do we have a Heung-min Son, so actually crucifying him is kind of off the table, no?
That's a very good point. Thanks for taking that literally.
But yeah, no, it didn't look very nice.
Okay.
What more do you want from me, West Ham fans?
West Ham fans are saying, had that been Julian Dix, he'd have been sent to prison.
If that had been Julian Dix, he would have said, well, there's Julian Dix again playing a game of football and the world moves on. It's like these sort of sayings are all really silly.
Yeah. Danny Rose, speaking before this game, actually, about whether he'd go into coaching and on the decision by UEFA over Montenegro's fans' racist chanting. It says he's lost for words after Montenegro were ordered to play their next home game behind closed doors. Also received a fine of €20,000. He says, I don't think it's harsh enough. I'm not surprised. Obviously, a bit of a shame. This is where we're at now, and we just have to get on with it. Rose also says, look, people ask me if I want to do my coaching badges, why you're not given a chance. So, no, I wouldn't be looking to do my badges. It's a waste of time. That's what I meant by I'm looking forward to calling it a day when the time is right. Referring as well to the fact that Sol Campbell had to go to the bottom of League Two.
But he went to a fine club.
He did go to a fine club, and we'll be on to Macclesfield later in the pod. Spurs host Ajax on Tuesday. Ajax had the weekend off. No Son for Spurs. Lars, would Spurs take 0-0 right now?
I think they would, just because that would have meant Ajax haven't scored an away goal, which would be good news all around. And the way the competition is with the importance of the away goal, keeping a clean sheet in the first game is almost more important than scoring, which sounds completely absurd, but that's how it is. And especially with Son out, yeah, absolutely.
Arsenal are fifth, three defeats in a row now, 3-0 away at Leicester. They were down to 10 men for the 36th minute, but Leicester were all over them before that, Barry, weren't they?
Yeah, I actually expected Leicester to win this game, and they duly did. And yes, as you say, Arsenal were down, a man down, but we had it on in the studio and they were getting absolutely mullered. Again, sloppy defending is costing Arsenal. They just make the most rudimentary errors game after game after game, whether they're individual errors or, a goal kick sails over defenders' heads.
It's unbelievable that. I mean, that, literally unreal.
If that happened in your Saturday team, you'd be furious,
How is that possible?
I
watched that guy, I just couldn't believe. How is that possible? How are they playing such a high line against Jamie Vardy? We learned this a couple of years ago, right? We learned don't play a high line against Jamie Vardy.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Brendan Rodgers talk about how tactically intelligent he's found Jamie Vardy working with him. And I'm sure that's the case. But the absolute opposite of tactical intelligence is to do that against Jamie Vardy, who I think is approaching 32 years old now, and when is he ever going to slow down?
It's a good question.
He is so fast at that age. Players, say fleet-footed players of Ryan Giggs or whatever, the legs are gone by that point. Whereas Vardy, it just keeps going.
But all you have to do there
is step back.
Well, one of you drop. One contest the ball, and one of you drop, and then then Vardy might have a one-on-one.
Which he might win as well. Yeah.
But even still, at least there is a player there. Totally mind-blowing that.
And the thing is, though, that Emery has, and deservedly so, has a reputation of one of the great technocrats of football, yet his team do not seem to get those messages. They conceded three goals three times in a week, and it was Palace, Wolves and Leicester. That doesn't really speak very well of his team, does it?
Arsenal recorded just 32.8% possession. That is the lowest they've ever had in a Premier League football match. And Leicester don't love having the ball, do they?
Yeah, all of this is true. I just think we need to bear in mind that they did have a man sent off after half an hour who also shouldn't have been sent off, and I think we need to colour our sort of analysis a little bit.
Which of his yellows were you not happy with?
They're both a bit soft, aren't they? Like,
well, the first, I think, is a yellow because it's that sort of coming across someone when they're escaping. The second, there's that discussion, isn't there, between Maitland-Niles and Maddison after... of, you said, you know, you were lucky there. You I know what you did. And they obviously played together at under-21 level. He did him there. I mean, the thing is, actually, in the third Leicester goal, in the build-up to that, you see James Maddison doing exactly the same sort of rolling around and feeling how injured he is. And yet, after the game, he was able to give a perfectly lucid interview. I think Maddison's an excellent player, had a good season. Started very well, went off the boil a bit, and he's now playing very well again. But there is that side to him, that theatrical side. And one thing, actually, talking about James Maddison, the whip he gets on the ball. Very David Beckham, a very David Bentley, who himself was a David Beckham impressionist. So do you think that has to have been a childhood inspiration? So.
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah. 7 goals, 7 assists in his first season in the Premier League. He's a lovely footballer.
Brilliant,
he?
Yeah.
And but you're putting him in the shithouse 11.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
But they're just very good, all in all, Leicester. If you go through their team, and, I mean, in a way, it's a bit nonsensical that that's where the threshold is, but just look at their players and say which of these would do a perfectly decent job in a top six team. It's a heck of a lot of them. And, I mean, if you compare man for man them and Arsenal, I'm not convinced the Arsenal squad is actually that much better than the Leicester squad at all. So if they... Big if they can keep Tielemans, because he's obviously going to be a man in demand this summer, and Monaco will extort a significant fee of money, I think, for whoever ends up signing him, because he's done really, really well. But if they can make a few canny signings, like the Everton Cup front runners, possibly for next season, maybe even beyond.
Just a stat on Vardy, 18 goals for him this season. Just 2 off his total for last season. He's played 12 hours less football as well. So, yeah.
Thank you, Claude Puel, for that as well, for playing less.
Oh, yes, yes, exactly. Yes.
So, you know, that was the suicide note, really, from Claude Puel.
Wasn't it? Wasn't it just? And a stat from Daniel Storey. The clubs in third to sixth in the Premier League have dropped 16 points in the last 5 days. Manchester City and Liverpool have dropped 14 points in 2019. And we will talk about them in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. On the 10th of May, which isn't too far away, at Earth in Hackney, a reunion gig going back to Earth in Hackney. Me, Barry, Lars and Jonathan... It's next week, is it? Crikey. Me, Barry, Lars, Jonathan Wilson joins us for a live show. Please come. Right, Liverpool 5, Huddersfield Town 0. We were talking about bad defending with Arsenal, John. Would you say Liverpool, in the last, since Klopp has been there, have given any indication they might press a team early? And in which case, what are Huddersfield doing in the first minute?
Well, they've been Huddersfield Town, one of the worst teams to have ever shown up in the Premier League, with a manager who seems to have fallen out with his players, having been there for about 2 minutes. You know, let's go back to Roy Keane. What was the phrase? Fail to prepare, prepare to fail was one of his watchwords. And it seems that they didn't bother doing any of that. Or if they did, they didn't listen to the manager. Or they're just not good enough. And Liverpool, who are going to go at teams from the very start, got the job done from those very first few seconds. Though not the quickest goal we'd had that week, obviously, because Shane Long goal machine had already got the quickest ever goal. Too easy for Liverpool. And if you were Manchester City, you probably would have expected that, but you would have had your head in your hands from the first, well, 15 seconds or whatever it was.
Tolly says, would the guy Sky Sports incorrectly thought was Huddersfield manager actually have done a better job? Martin from Wakefield.
Possibly. I have a feeling Jan Sievert won't be there at the start of next season. Could be wrong, but he already strikes me as someone who's, you know, what does he say after the game? We caused them problems and that makes me proud. Well, did you?
Oh, there was a couple of breaks when it was 3 or 4 nil.
The thing is, though, it's like the cult of Dortmund, I suppose, because you've got Jürgen Klopp at the very top, who's a fantastic manager, and then you've got Thomas Tuchel, who also a fine manager at PSG, and then Daniel Farke, you know, done a great job at Norwich City. There had to be one of them that wasn't very good, and Huddersfield got that guy. And David Wagner, of course, he was the guy they tried to imitate, who did, you know, David Wagner, there should be a statue to David Wagner in Huddersfield for bringing that club up there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they got the bad penny.
I want to both defend both Huddersfield and Jan Sievert, because Huddersfield are an example of a team who got promoted on a budget and a squad you should never get promoted on. And then instead of betting the farm and signing loads of players Fulham style, they kind of spent quite sensibly and didn't want to explode the budget and whatever, and incredibly managed to stay up. I thought it was unbelievable that they stayed up. And they were kind of, it always seemed likely they were going to go down and go down badly this season. And I think it's not necessarily for clubs of that stature. I don't think it's no great shame in that, really, in my opinion. I think it's smarter of them to do that than to sign a bunch of players they can't afford to keep paying when they eventually do go down again. But, and like, I'm sorry, but Jan Sievert, like, what are you going to do? You're taking over a team halfway through the season, yeah, who's definitely going down. Now, I'm sure there are better ways than going about it than he has. He seems to have fallen out with the players, like you say, and maybe there would have been a way of avoiding that. He seems needlessly angry on the sidelines sometimes. But then again, you want a passionate guy in charge. And I don't know, it's an impossible situation for him, I think.
I suppose the thing is that they couldn't persuade David Wagner to do a Sean Dyche, which was to come up, realise that you're probably not good enough to stay up, and then continue to build on with the team. Dean Hoyle, the owner, is a rich man, but he isn't rich enough to buy the players that will probably keep that team up. So the thing is, if you want to do a Burnley, you've got to come up with the team confident and the ability to build again. And as Barry said, is Sievert going to be there next season? I'd be quite surprised at this point.
Salah and Mane both going for the golden boot. Salah on 21, Mane on 20, along with Sergio Aguero. He's very good. He's better in the air, Sadio Mane, than I gave him credit for, Barry. Certainly the second header was brilliant.
Yeah, and he's scored quite a few with his head this season, just remembering off the top of my own head. And he's not a big fella, is he? But the marking was negligent. You know, I the one thing I've never been able to do is head a football properly. Well, it's one of many things I've never been able to do in the field of sporting endeavour. But yeah, heading a football, I just couldn't do it for love or money. And you were saying yesterday, it's a surprisingly underrated skill, but he certainly seems to have it.
Yeah, the power and the precision he put on the second header was absolutely superb. Miguel Delaney tweeting, if you look at the goals which change results, equalisers or goals to put your team ahead, Salah's goals have been directly responsible for 24 points this season, double that of Aguero or Sterling. Is there a case that we, in the same way that we sort of underrate Messi because he's so good all the time, we are not appreciating what Salah's done this season because of what he did last year?
Massively so. And I think, you know, the fact that Mane was on the shortlist for the PFA award and not him is a bit of a travesty, but that all comes down to when the votes are cast, I suppose. I think the ballots go out in early March, which is when he was having his dry spell, so I suppose that impacts how people are thinking. But Salah is actually having an absolutely brilliant season. Now, it's only human nature, I guess, when he comes from having an outlandish season and then is slightly less good the next year, to talk about the fact that he's slightly less good. But you're completely right. He has been very, very brilliant and should be a candidate for Player of the Year, really.
I thought you were going to rattle out that stat and say, is there a case that Miguel needs to spend more time in nightclubs in Putney?
Well, I was going to say, that was written in the Fez Club in Putney.
He was tweeting that while he was at the PFA Awards, which I imagine was insipidly boring, as those events always are. Virgil van Dijk won the Players' Player of the Year, although the only one I've been to, it was fun to watch Wiley performing to Roy Hodgson. which was an interesting... I don't know, it was just fun to watch Roy Hodgson bobbing his head up and down to Wiley.
You weren't there for the Reginald D. Hunter one.
No, I missed that one.
That one looked good.
Van Dijk won the Player of the Year. I think we're all agreed he's quite good at football. Liverpool travelled to Barcelona on Wednesday. Lars, the fact that Barca have sewn up La Liga must be a massive advantage, right?
Yeah, it's good for them. They can rotate and... Well, the fact that they have Leo Messi is a massive advantage, and the fact that they've made him, that's the obvious point to make, and the fact that he, even by his standard, is having a really, really good year, and how Liverpool deal with that, I think, is an important, interesting thing to note. And that was, for as much as United have been bad recently and done most things wrong, I did think they sort of vaguely succeeded a little bit in keeping him quiet-ish at Old Trafford.
How did
in those
they do
games.
That?
Well, they played Dalot on the left side there, so he had a right-footed player to cope with the fact that he's coming inside. I think that might be part of it.
And they also played Phil Jones as well, you know.
Yeah, but that's not an option that's available to Liverpool.
Are you saying swap Robertson and Alexander-Arnold?
No, but I wonder if this could be a time for James Milner to make an appearance in a sort of a keep track of Messi type role.
Oh, why not? Also, nice to see Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain back. I think everybody likes him. So they won. I meant City had to win at Burnley, and they did. They did enough, Barry, didn't they? 29 millimetres over the line, Aguero's goal. But I don't know, I got the feeling they were always going to win, or at least at no point did they seem stressed about it.
I think there was a slight sense of urgency. The goal probably came just the right time, if that doesn't sound... Actually, that does sound a bit daft. But I say, watching it personally, I was beginning to go, ooh, you know, are they going to score? And then they did. But I saw a desperation about them, or an urge towards the end, that I haven't seen before. You know, normally you can rely on them no matter what's happening. They play it out from the back. Yesterday, it was hoofing it into the stand. And you don't see City do that very often. But again, they closed it out. And here we are having the same conversation again for the, you know, nth week in a row. Will they drop points against, who is it next week?
Leicester.
And they might, you know.
I think you can always tell when Pep Guardiola's getting worried, because he sheds his mandigan and throws it to the side. And there was that edge of perspiration about Pep. Now, he's that type of person that doesn't sweat unless he's, you know, working out at sort of Bikram yoga temperatures or something like that. And there is that... I think of the two teams, City have a bit more bottle potential, and that's possibly down to Pep himself, supreme manager, but someone I think whose tension can get to the players. And there was a point during that game, during the second half, when I thought City might not get there, and a draw wasn't good enough for them. But and they got it done by 2.7 centimetres.
2.9.
2.9, okay. Yeah. Now, the thing
is basically 3 centimetres.
Basically,
isn't it,
3 centimetres. And the thing is, one of those things where when I saw it, I thought, that's well over the line. That's okay. And it's quite strange, wasn't it? Because it came off Lowton and went behind him, the force of the ball. But it was the one time where Burnley didn't have 8 men behind the ball, just creating some sort of, I don't know, Game of Thrones style defence technique.
I don't watch Game of Thrones. Is it just watching Burnley play football, or is there more to it?
There is a touch of the Night's Watch about them.
Yes, there is, definitely. And Sean Dyche would be... he'd fit in well there, I think, it's fair to say. I'm always amused by Sean Dyche's post-match talk, because it always begins with a defence of how his team plays. Well, you know, with the players we have and blah, blah, blah. And... it just always is so defensive. You know, just be prouder of yourself, Sean.
Dan says, can anyone call Burnley anti-football with a straight face when City ended the game with 6 defenders? Burnley had 2 shots, both off target. Manchester City had 25.
Burnley racked up a frankly scandalous 30% possession. That's a lot more than I thought they was going to get. I mean, I joke, but there's part truth there, actually. I would have thought that City would dominate this game even more. And Aguero, again, like you... it won't go down as one of the great goals, but I think it's actually a really impressive individual effort getting the shots away in the sort of tight spaces that he does. And he's completely amazing at this, Aguero, and I think he's in such a strange space in the sort of football discourse in this country where he's universally accepted as being completely brilliant. Yeah, I feel like he's still a little bit underrated. I mean, since he came to City, only one season, it's been 8 seasons, and only one of them has he finished with fewer than 28 goals in all competitions. I mean, it's extraordinary numbers. He's in the team of the year again, but that's only the second time in 8 seasons he's in the team of the year, which I think is, he's never won player of the year. I think there's a brilliance there that goes almost unappreciated, because part of what he does, these little quick finishes in tight spaces, which are incredibly hard, and so a few other players in world football can do, but they maybe don't look that spectacular.
I agree with you 100%, Lars. I'll give you, if it was question time and I was in the audience, I'd applaud you. Southampton 3, Bournemouth 3. The point guarantees Southampton's Premier League status. I mean, they were pretty much safe anyway, but it meant they had a chance to have a big huddle and jump up and down in the middle of the pitch after the game. They started this season with 9 points in 15 games. Since Ralf Hasenhüttl took over, they've got 29 points in 21. They've beaten Spurs, Arsenal and Wolves at home. Clean sheets have been few and far between. They've failed to score, though, in just 3 games since he took over. By comparison, Spurs have failed to score 4 times in the same period. Bournemouth, in the same period, have failed to score 9 times. We should praise Ralf Hasenhüttl, Barry.
Yeah, he's doing a very good job. Southampton fans appear delighted to have him. It'll be interesting to see how they get on when he has a summer to bring in some players, get rid of some players, get a pre-season into the players. And one imagines the pre-season, you know, going by their style of play, pre-season for Southampton players would be extremely unpleasant, I suspect. But, the worry, of course, then is if they kick on, is that one of the bigger teams will try and poach him. And that's just life at Southampton, isn't it?
That's another one from the cult of Klopp, isn't it? That... I mean, I know that he's not worked for Borussia Dortmund, but it's that similar English clubs looking towards that German high-pressing thing. And, you know, he's the Alpine Klopp. That's what they called him, didn't they? I saw that Callum Wilson scored twice in this game.
I had a great chance in the last minute.
Well, actually, the 2 stats about him, that Callum Wilson has his second highest on the missed chances in the league. But also this other one, that he's the only English player to both score and assist in more Premier League games in a single season than Callum Wilson in this season was Alan Shearer.
Really?
In 94-95 when Blackburn won the title.
Well, there were rumours of Wilson to Chelsea. I mean, obviously we know as an established centre-forward, that's the last place
he should go. Yeah, that's the end for him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Will says, in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Bill and Ted use their time machine to go on an intensive guitar course. Has Shane Long done the same with goal scoring? Rich goal scoring reign of form, isn't he? 4 in his last 5. Although he did hit the post from about 4 centimetres as well.
But he has this in him. Like, I went through this a few years ago. I went through this weird streak of every time I saw Shane Long, he had a great game and scored, which is a number of years ago, as you can imagine. But I'm relieved to see that he's doing this again, and that this wasn't just a phase of my life I imagined or dreamt up. Like, he is capable of... There is a really good striker in Shane Long, and you only see him sometimes. But the thing is, when you don't see that really good striker, what you have is a guy who runs an incredible amount and has like speed and physicality and all that, which I guess in the sort of high-pressing stylings of Ralf Hasenhüttl is a very useful thing to have around.
Fulham 1, Cardiff 0. Devastating blow for Cardiff. Now 4 points behind Brighton with 2 games to go. Fulham still upsetting people since they were relegated. Barry, you were confused by Cardiff's approach to this game.
Yeah, you say it was a devastating blow. I'd say a self-inflicted blow, because they went out looking like a team who were content to get a draw. Didn't really attack until they went behind, and then created, well, I counted 8 chances in the last 10 minutes. Probably unlucky not to get a draw, because they should have had a penalty. But, I was slightly mystified by their approach to this game, and the jig looks up for them now, because Brighton just basically need 1 point to... Mm. Secure their safety.
A lovely finish from Ryan Babel, wasn't it? If that's the only thing he does, then it was nice to have him.
Well, I was looking at this. I think the January transfer window is one of those things which may as well not exist. But the best signing of last year's January transfer window was Virgil van Dijk, who it turns out he's quite a good player. Mm-hmm. But the best signing of this January transfer window was Ryan Babel.
Was it?
I think so. He's shown.
I might take it back.
He's probably good enough to play in the Premier League next season in the time he's been at Fulham, and he might get a contract. Now, you would have thought you'd associate Ryan Babel with the era of, I don't know, Albert Riera or Jan Kromkamp from Liverpool days gone by. Yet he's reasserted himself. I saw him play for Holland the other week, and he's absolutely excellent. So, good to have him back, and that was a great goal.
How many Fulham and Cardiff players will still be in the Premier League next season? How many do you think will leave and go to?
Well, looking at the Fulham team, Sessegnon would be one that you would expect someone would take a chance on, though not for the fee that Fulham would have got a year ago.
Mitrovic? No?
I mean, there was a miss in that game that made me think he's probably... He is in the sort of Darren Huckabee, brilliant in the Championship, probably not good enough for the Premier League level.
He still strikes me as the kind of player West Ham would go for.
Yes, because he's not that good. and with Cardiff, yes, interesting. Camarasa, I think, is maybe the one player that I would look at.
Quiz time. There are 13 players who were relegated last season who are playing in the Premier League this season. Name two to win.
What?
I can't even remember who was relegated.
There are 13 players.
Alfie Mawson played in this game specifically, went down with Swansea.
Correct, that's one.
And
Stoke, Swansea and West Brom.
Yeah, I remember.
Oh, Fabianski.
Yeah. Fabianski also went down with Swansea.
From Stoke, Ramadan Sobi, Lee Grant, sort of counts. Lars, you're the winner. Shaqiri and Peter Crouch. From Swansea, Ayu, Key, Mawson, Fernandez, Fabianski, West Brom, Evans, Foster, Sacco and Rondon. Rondon did a great chest, didn't he, to set up Ayoze Perez in that Brighton game. A massive goal from Pascal Gross, which looks like it'll keep Brighton in the Premier League.
But Chris Hughton probably.
Do you think he's done?
I think he's done, yeah.
Really?
And I mean, it's a killing Bambi sort of thing, isn't it? But I don't
Bambi's mum. Nobody kills Bambi. Classic.
You could.
Textbook to
thought,
a boy.
I
early.
Thought you
if
weren't.
You did,
I'm sorry, Barry.
It would also be sad.
But
if you killed Bambi.
You're a no spoilers man. And that's one of the biggest spoilers there's ever been.
44 years ago. If you haven't seen it by now.
Even still.
It's a turn of phrase, Barry.
I think the turn of phrase still works.
Yes.
Because if you killed Bambi, that would also be sad.
Anyway, John, the point you were making about Chris Hughton's future.
It's so painful to see Chris Hughton, the nicest guy in football, TM, suffering as he was during that game. And there was a point before that goal where it really looked very bad for him. I mean, Brighton are now going to stay up, but they haven't progressed since last season. An awful lot of money spent on players who most people would struggle to name because they haven't made any impact for Brighton this season. And I think the owner of Brighton, Tony Bloom, is probably going to have to take a decision this summer if they want Brighton to stay in the Premier League.
That goal broke a club record of 11 hours and 13 minutes since their last goal, which had stood since 1970. Could have been better. Glenn Murray missed a header in the last minute, didn't it? So they still do need something mathematically. Brighton have Arsenal away, so that's 3 points, and then City at home. And Cardiff home to Palace, not that easy, and Manchester United away. So tricky for both of them. Watford 1, Wolves 2. Wolves now 4 points clear in the race for the Everton Cup. And Crystal Palace 0, Everton 0. Kevin Day writing, to save the editors of Match of the Day the bother, 5 seconds for the guy to save, 10 seconds for the shot that hit the bar, 20 seconds for a montage of Everton corners, 0 seconds for our chances. I'd bung on Tom and Jerry for the rest.
I mean,
Lars.
Only Huddersfield have taken fewer points at home this season than Crystal Palace. Both Fulham and Cardiff have picked up more points at home than Palace. Like, this is not great. I mean, their away form is prodigious, but you know, I think just for the sake of the fans, like, they've got great support there. And I think if you're going to be one of these teams who don't get relegated but don't challenge for Europe either, I think a key part is of making your fans happy and enjoy the ride is like giving them something to shout about at home. Like, so they've got to figure this out.
Yeah, good point. Football League time. The most fun bit of the weekend was at Elland Road, wasn't it? Leeds basically resigned to a playoff place because of Sheffield United's win on Saturday. They drew 1-1 with Villa. Villa striker Jonathan Codger goes down injured in a challenge with Leeds' Liam Cooper. Leeds look like they're going to play on. Then Tyler Roberts, brilliantly, looks like he's going to put it out. Everyone stops. And then he plays it down the line to Mateusz Klich, who slots it home. Total bedlam. Klich can't celebrate because he's basically being assaulted by half the Aston Villa side. Players going down like flies. Patrick Bamford collapsed and held his face when he was pushed in the chest by Villa's Ahmed El Ghazi, who was sent off. Richard did write, do we know what grade Patrick Bamford got in drama? Then Bielsa orders his team to let Villa equalise. Albert Adoma runs through. All the Leeds players let him, except for Pontus Janssen. One man, you shall not pass. He didn't get the memo, did he? Bielsa and John Terry having a massive row on the sideline. Question, if promotion had still been a realistic possibility for Leeds, would Bielsa have made the same call?
Possibly. I wouldn't put it past him, to be honest. But he's a very eccentric man and a very unpredictable man. So he possibly might have, yes.
I think he would as well, because I think he has, and this might sound weird after Spygate, but I think he has a very sort of strong sense of morality to him. The point about Spygate was that he just didn't realise in this country this was considered bad, because I guess it's hard for normal people to realise that standing on public land looking through a fence is somehow breaching a moral code in a terrible way. I mean, that doesn't make sense to us foreign types. But this seems like a very Bielsa-type thing to do, just the right thing has to be observed.
Tim says, I don't see why everyone's raving about Bielsa letting the opposition score unopposed. Mustafi's been doing it all season.
Hey. I keep wondering, what if Janssen had successfully dispossessed Adoma and he would just stood there with the ball? Would the rest of the Leeds player have tried to get it off him again so they could go and score? Would it have been Janssen versus the world?
But the Janssen thing, though, he didn't really try and stop him. It was totally plain to the gallery. It's the type of thing that the person who proved himself during that debate on the sideline, the true warrior of truth and justice, John Terry, of course. It's the type of thing that I think JT might have done in that situation as well. But now that John is older and a more mature member of football society and, you know, is able to show Marcelo Bielsa the correct way in English football, it was just good to have him around to tell us what should be happening.
Does Bielsa get some sort of award for seemingly rattling both Frank Lampard and John Terry in his first season in England? It's good going.
So Norwich and Sheffield United are up. So Norwich and Sheffield United are up after beating Blackburn and Ipswich respectively. We should praise them both. I don't think Daniel Farke or Chris Wilder were anyone's predictions to get automatic promotion, were they?
No, is it Chris Wilder has got teams promoted from the 5th, 4th, 3rd and 2nd tiers of English football, which is some achievement. And also, something to say about Chris Wilder, and I have family from this fair city. I haven't seen anyone who looks more like he comes from Sheffield than Chris Wilder. There's a certain look to the good burgers of that city.
Can you describe?
Well, it's sort of round-faced, sort of cheery, sometimes, you know, jolly.
Jolly.
Okay. Jolly.
Craig,
the woman who works the stage door of the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield, where the snooker is being played at the moment, is quite possibly the friendliest person I've ever met.
Hmm. Do you have any nice Sheffield?
Oh, only to say that I'm reliably informed that Chris Wilder's assistant, Alan Nil, also deserves some credit. He's apparently a very accomplished tactician and a big part of the brains trust behind that promotion.
I think he once ate a squirrel, but I must check that.
Well, so did my dog.
See, he ate a squirrel and he pioneered the overlapping centre-back, which
it's
is part
really
of
fascinating,
the
isn't it?
Sheffield United
I looked this up.
Tactic,
it's really good. If you haven't seen Sheffield United play or indeed looked up their stats, like check the heat maps and the sort of passing locations for their wide centre.
I do that type of thing every night, as you know.
This is from the 5th of September 2012. Manager Alan Nil says Scunthorpe's difficult start to the season has been put in perspective after he almost suffered serious injury when his bicycle collided with a squirrel. I got hit by a squirrel. I went over the squirrel might have a different story. I got hit by a squirrel. I went over the top of my bike and landed on my head, shoulder and neck. I saw it run into the road. I couldn't do anything about it. I just hit my wheel and it stuck in my wheel and hit my brakes. Ow.
But he didn't eat it.
No, he didn't. I got that wrong. Alan Neil did not eat a squirrel. That's true. Most worrying story from the Championships at the bottom, isn't it? Bolton Wanderers. Their game against Brentford was called off by the EFL after Bolton's players said they would not play until they received wages they're owed. None of the March wages have been paid. EFL said the club is now deemed to be guilty of misconduct, will be referred to an independent disciplinary commission. The Professional Football Association said on Friday they support the players' actions. Lawrence Bassini, the guy who's trying to buy it, says he believes the postponed championship match will be played this week. The owner, Ken Anderson, and him have been having a go at each other. Anderson saying if Bassini did not provide proof of funds by today, he'd explore other options. It's just a sorry story from all sides, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, including the EFL, who shouldn't have let it get anywhere near this far. And their suggestion that they would have forced Bolton's under 18 team to play, and to all intents and purposes provide scab labour and cross a picket line, was outrageous. In the end they didn't, because the team had played a game on Thursday night, so it would have been detrimental to their welfare or whatever, but I think the under 18s would have been well within their rights to refuse. But it would be an awful thing to put kids like that under that kind of pressure, to more or less betray their colleagues, more senior colleagues. But yeah, it's a mess. Bassini shouldn't be allowed to own a football club. Anderson has proven he's shouldn't be allowed to own a football club, and the EFL shouldn't be allowed to run a football league. And no one is coming out of this with any credit.
Ipswich are down with Bolton. Rotherham joined them after a 2-1 defeat at West Brom. In League One, Luton have stuttered at the worst time, conceded that late equaliser in midweek. They lost 2-1 at Burton. Holy Carruthers was on Soccer Saturday getting very sad about that. Despite taking the lead, Barnsley level on points with them now. They both need a win on the final day to guarantee promotion. If either of them slip up, Portsmouth, who drew with Sunderland, can nick it. They've got a game in hand against Peterborough on Tuesday night. They need to win that and on the final day. At the bottom, Accrington, Rochdale and Bristol Rovers are all safe. 3 of 7 could go down with Bradford. Jeff Stelling will need to be on his game on Saturday with those permutations. League 2, Yeovil are down. They were 2-0 up at Northampton, but pegged back to a 2-2 draw. They've really been in free fall for the second half of the season. The teams below them both won, Notts County and John Bruin's Macclesfield. A draw against the mighty Cambridge will be enough to survive unless Notts County win 8-0. How well has Sol Campbell done to get you into this position?
Well, they were dead and buried when Sol came in. I watched a little documentary made with him where he was at the training ground in Sandbach. And obviously it was a very positive documentary. But I do think, and he's proved a lot of people wrong with the job that he's done. I wouldn't be alone in thinking this was a crazy appointment. But it was at a point where Macclesfield had to try something. And credit to them for trying it. And credit to Sol for actually getting them into a position which looked beyond any realm of possibility. So, well done to Sol. Let's hope they see it out. And actually, let's hope Cambridge chuck one in David De Gea style, because football would be the winner in that case.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not hard to beat Cambridge. Many teams have done it, so you should be all right, is what I think.
Yes. Well, let's hope so.
Joining Lincoln in League One, promoted from League Two, will be two of Bury, Mansfield and MK Dons. Bury can do it on Tuesday if they beat Tranmere. Leyton Orient are into League Two, promoted from the National League. On Monday, they drew at second place Solihull Moors. That was crucial. A point was enough at the weekend, and they drew 0-0 with relegated Braintree. None of the top three won either of their two games. Salford lost both of them. So there's that playoff thing where fourth place seventh and fifth place sixth. They then have a final, and then they play the winners of a game between second and third. Then they play Salford, and then the winners play Solihull Moors. It goes on forever, basically, but it's quite fun.
I mean, I would like to see, there should be a Gary Neville cam on those Salford games. I mean, you see some of the figures they've invested into that club to not go up, and I am delighted that Leyton Orient have gone up, because, you know, they had such a tough time, mm-hmm, over the years. But it is the class of 92 There's going to be a big focus on them, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. And he says, special mention of Stockport County. Took 3,500 fans to Nuneaton to see a county league title for the first time since the 60s. They're up from the National League North. Couple of classic sides in the playoffs, Blythe Spartans and Bradford Park Avenue. Torquay won the National South at a canter. Well done to Gary Johnson. Fit by corner, Barry, and some more sad news from the Lisbon Lions.
Yeah, Billy McNeil obviously died and... on a fairly quiet week in Scotland, Celtic paid a lot of homage to him in his memory, and you couldn't really have scripted it better because they beat Kilmarnock 1-0. Jozo Simonovic, who wears the same number as Billy McNeil, number 5, scored in the 67th minute. And obviously 1967 was the year in which the Lisbon Lions triumphed in the European Cup. And today, Monday, we've had the same sad news that another of the Lisbon Lions, Steve Chalmers, has died aged 83. He scored the winner in that European Cup final, played 263 league games for Celtic. So, yeah, it's sad coincidence, I suppose, and a sad time for the club.
In women's football, Chelsea are out of the Champions League after a 1-1 draw at home to Lyon. Over 4,500 at King's Meadow to watch them lose 3-2 on aggregate. Lyon went ahead through Eugenie Le Sommer's deflected shot. Chelsea hit back with a Ji So-yeon free kick. Their best chance to take it to extra time was Karen Carney, who hit the post. But Lyon, look, they're one of the best sides in the women's game, aren't they? Through to the fourth straight final. They're eighth since 2010, and they'll play Barcelona, who beat Bayern Munich 1-0 on the day, 2-0 on aggregate. Arsenal have won the league for the first time in 7 years. They won 4-0 at Brighton in front of a new record WSL attendance. And Vivian Miedema's opened the scoring. She was named PFA Women's Player of the Year last night. They'll play in the Women's Champions League next season for the first time since 2014, along with Manchester City, who'll finish the season in second. And that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll start in Germany with Archie Rintat. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Germany with Archie Rintat. Archie, how are you?
Very well, Max. Excellent. Very well. News. Very excited right now.
Why?
Because the title race is bloody awesome over here.
It is good, isn't it? It was the Ruhr Valley Derby on Saturday. Dortmund, Schalke. Dortmund desperately trying to keep pace with Bayern, and they blew it. What happened?
Yeah. So there's a historical precedent to this, which mentioned briefly last week on the podcast, and that is, once upon a time in 2007, Borussia Dortmund, on the penultimate match day of the Bundesliga season, tore apart Schalke's dreams of winning their first Bundesliga title. Schalke were German champions a couple of times before the creation of the Bundesliga, but never since its creation in the early 60s have they done it. So Dortmund took great pride in the fact that they tore down those chances. So for Schalke, this was very much revenge for 2007. And what's more, it covers up for what has been the second worst season in their history. But there's so much controversy about this win for Schalke on Saturday, mainly because Dortmund went 1-0 up after a ridiculous assist from Jadon Sancho. Fantastic chip through ball to Mario Götze, who headed in, and everyone's thinking, right, is it going to be a case of how many Dortmund get here? But then our friend VAR gave Schalke quite a generous penalty for a handball, which Lucien Favre, the Dortmund coach, has called the biggest scandal in years. And I can see where he's coming from, because I don't think that Julian Weigl has really done much to kind of extend his body in an unnatural way, I think is the phrasing for it. Anyway, Schalke score that. They then score from a corner, which is very Dortmund-esque to concede from this season. And then in the second half, Marco Reus, Dortmund's talisman and captain, etc., is sent off for, like, quite correctly, in my opinion, for a terrible tackle. Dortmund down to 10. Marius, and then from that free kick, Schalke score 3-1. Marius Wolf then gets sent off again for Dortmund, down to 9 men. They pull one back through Axel Witsel, 3-2, but then Braylon Borlo finishes it off 4-2. And you're thinking, right, so there goes the title race then, because Bayern have to go to Nuremberg on Sunday, which is where I was yesterday. And then Nuremberg, who, to be fair, have been playing better, turn up in spectacular style. Bayern really don't. And Nuremberg take the lead. This is a Franconian-Bavarian derby, for those who are interested as well. And so Nuremberg really do not like Bayern, and they've not beaten them in this game since 2007. Bayern get a very lucky goal through Serge Gnabry, and then in the 89th minute, Nuremberg get a penalty. Now, Nuremberg have to win this game as well, because they were 6 points away from Stuttgart in the relegation playoff spot. Nuremberg missed this penalty for a guy called Tim Leibold, and this is the third penalty in a row they've missed, so really, really painful. And then in the final minute of stoppage time, Kingsley Coman goes through on goal, one-on-one. He gets about a 60-meter run-up. And Christian Matenia, the Nuremberg goalkeeper, who had an absolutely world-class game, saves it. So then comes the full-time whistle, and both sides are blown out. But it means that there's only 2 points now between Bayern and Dortmund at the top, with 3 games to play. So very, very exciting indeed.
That fellow who missed the penalty, Tim Leibold, a left-back, right, who'd never scored a penalty before. Why? I mean, surely they've got someone better to take it, haven't they?
The problem is that the guys who are supposedly better at taking penalties have already missed their penalties. So it's kind of, I think, getting shared around to who's feeling the most confident.
Fair enough. Well, bad luck, Tim. Wonder who's next. A bit of an exciting race for the fourth Champions League spot. Does anyone in Germany want fourth place? I mean, no one in England does.
Very much so. And actually, that's the thing. The race for fourth is just as exciting. That you've got, I would say, still 5 teams in it, because Eintracht Frankfurt, the occupants of fourth spot, have got to go to Bayer Leverkusen, who are 3 points below them, next weekend. And they've got to go to Bayern on the final day. I mean, Bayern have a really difficult run in terms of two of their 3 games. If you had to pick 2 teams who you would not want to face right now, it would be Leipzig, who qualified for the Champions League this weekend, and Frankfurt. So Frankfurt lead that race for fourth, and they drew 0-0 at the weekend. I saw them home to Hertha. I think very much withholding a little bit ahead of the Chelsea game in the Europa League semi-final. Biggest game they've had in probably 25, 30 years at least. And then below them, you've got Gladbach, 3 points back from them, who have somewhat tossed away the Champions League place. They lost 1-0 away at Stuttgart, who are fighting for their lives at the bottom. Then you've got Leverkusen. If you've not seen Kai Havertz's goal for Leverkusen on Friday night, they won 4-1 away at Augsburg. It was terrific. A first-time lob over the keeper from a very short distance out. And Havertz, who is 19 and setting the world on fire, is one to watch. And then Hoffenheim are 4 points back from Frankfurt still. They lost to Wolfsburg, who are now a point behind them, 4-1. And until Sunday, you would have said Hoffenheim were actually probably looking like the outside favourites for that. So very exciting in that instance as well. And I mean, even the second division right now, that the race for promotion there, you've got 4 teams in the mix, and it looks like Hamburg are going to miss out because they lost to Union Berlin, who moved above them into third. But you've got Paderborn, who very much touched the void a couple of years ago, got relegated to the fourth division, got a reprieve because somebody didn't get their license, and they're now in second. And then you've got Cologne at the top of the table, who sacked their manager on Saturday with 4 games to play because they've been getting results but not playing very well. Now the results part of that's gone. So all-round craziness in Germany right now, I think, is the best way to put it.
Good stuff. Lots of excitement for you there, Archie. Thanks for coming on.
No worries, Max. Cheers.
Archie Rintup there, out in Germany. In Spain, Barcelona have retained La Liga with a win over Levante. Lionel Messi came off the bench to score the only goal of the game, like a special teams player. His 34th in the league this season. Barca's 8th league title in 11 years. Real Madrid lost 1-0 at 19th place Rayo Vallecano. Zinedine Zidane saying after the match they owed the supporters an apology for how they played. And, quote, from the first minute to the last minute, we did nothing. Still, they qualified for the Champions League earlier in the afternoon as Sevilla lost to Girona. Teams in third, fourth, fifth and sixth all lost. So Getafe still fourth on the same points as Sevilla in fifth, but ahead on head-to-head record. Just 12 goals across the 9 games played. so far. Half the number scored in the Premier League this weekend. Proof, once again, that the Premier League, the Barclays Premier League, is the greatest league in the world. To Italy now. Here is Paolo Bandini.
So, Inter against Juventus this past weekend, which should really have been one of the biggest games of the whole season. Obviously, they hate each other. It's the Derby d'Italia, the Derby of Italy, and there's so much brilliant needle between the two fan bases. Inter are, of course, the last Italian team to win the Champions League, which you might have heard is the one thing Juventus haven't been very good at winning. And the Ultras produced this epic game-over choreography for Inter in the Curva Nord of San Siro. Even more entertaining, I thought, were the bottles of Ajax cleaning fluid. Now, it's spelt the same way as Ajax, but obviously pronounced differently in Italian. It's a sort of standard cleaning fluid, like Sif in England. And fans attached big trophy arms to bottles to make them look like the Champions League, which I thought was very neat. But yes, you had all the pomp and circumstance for this game, really. But just a small problem of 26 points between Juventus and Inter in the standings. So Juventus barely even showed up for the first half, to be honest with you. And Raja Nainggolan did score a very lovely goal for Inter, but then Cristiano Ronaldo remembered he doesn't like losing, and so he scored the equaliser. Juventus got a point. That was his 600th goal of his professional career. Well done to him. But actually, there was a game that mattered more between teams from the exact two cities this weekend. No such rivalry between Torino and Milan, but Torino did beat Milan this weekend 2-0, and in doing so, they leapfrogged them into fifth place. Now, when it comes to wage bills and all that nonsense, Torino have no business being part of the Champions League race. But Walter Mazzarri, yes, he who got relegated with Watford, but does also have a couple of really impressive seasons at Napoli on his prior resume. He has turned them into this incredibly stubborn, hard-working and hard-to-break-down team this season. This was their 14th clean sheet of the campaign. Also, Mazzarri's sixth sending off of the campaign, which I think needs mentioning, but is, of course, its own different story. Torino have now got more points in Serie A in 2019 than any other team bar Juventus. Now, that said, Atalanta, who would be an even more unlikely team to make the top four, they could overtake them both in the standings and in the points in 2019 stakes if they beat Udinese on Monday night. So the battle for fourth place has got really interesting in Italy. It does, for now, belong to Roma, who beat Cagliari 3-0, and they probably are the favourites, given they seem to be playing better under Claudio Ranieri. He's got a handle on things, three clean sheets in the last four games, but still very much in the balance. And Torino, for their part, have another huge game coming up next week when they go away to Juventus in the Turin derby.
Thank you, Paolo. In France, Rennes beat PSG on penalties to win the Coupe de France. They drew 2-2 after PSG were 2-0 up. This was fun, Lars, wasn't it?
It's a lot of fun, especially for Hatem Ben Arfa, who famously had a very bad time at PSG and who's now been playing for Rennes, scored his penalty in the shootout, said afterwards that we pulled off a comeback, but PSG are used to that. So a bit of shithousery from Ben Arfa. And also, he said, it's special, especially regarding President Nasser of PSG, and saying, all adding, you should never underestimate your opponent in life. One day or another, he will come back stronger. And going on to say, one day, like me, Adrien Rabiot will come back up against PSG. Adrien Rabiot also frozen out at the moment at PSG, like Ben Arfa
was.
This
is great. Ben Arfa really just absolutely hammering everyone.
Getting stuck in. I've never seen him put in challenges like that on the pitch, but he's bringing it certainly off it, and it was very, very good.
Speaking of challenges on the pitch, Mbappe's red card.
Awful. Just really bad. Like, terrible tackle.
I mean, it's so high, isn't it? He goes in, it's literally just below knee height, and the knee jilts. It's disgusting. And what's he doing?
You wonder, it's... I don't want to be too harsh on Mbappe because he is a very young guy, and I think the PSG guys are very frustrated and all this, and he's not the biggest problem there. But the thing about him is, when he first came through, it wasn't just that he was an amazing player that was so eye-catching. It was also he seemed really mature. He spoke really well in interviews. He didn't do a lot of nonsense on the pitch. But he seems to be getting a bit more petulant and stroppy. He had a go at the players in the team recently and was left out as a result of it. I've seen him dive more recently than he was doing when he was younger. So it seems to be, again, not wanting to massively have a go at a guy who's still young. He seems to be slightly... It's like he was more mature a couple of years ago, which is weird for a kid that age. You wonder if he's being Neymar'd a little bit, which is not what you want to see.
Speaking of Neymar, played 120 minutes in just his second game back from injury. Lots of people on social media about saying he punched a Rennes fan on the way to collect his loser's medal. I'm not sure you would call it a punch.
He raised his hand to a fan, more of a
shove,
a clip.
But, I mean, would Neymar have gone down if that had been done to him?
Probably.
Still be rolling. James Maddison would have done.
Yeah.
Can I just say, though, I'm entirely on Team Neymar here. Because certainly according to the videos I've seen on social media, this idiot was standing there with his camera sort of filming and goading people who were going to put out, pick up their runners-up medals. Like, oh, I swear to God, if you're stood there, like, I don't advocate violence against fans, but like, if you're stood there trying to get a reaction with your stupid camera so you can make a viral video, you know what? Worse things have happened in football this weekend than this dude getting a slap.
Producer Jonathan, I don't advocate violence against fans,
no,
but I advocate violence against fans.
And a bit of a slap was right for this fella. Just have a word with yourself. Like, who raised you, honestly?
Also this week, wow, well, suddenly sort of turning into some right-wing shock jock.
Come on. Just don't be an ass.
Also this week, Neymar was given a 3-game Champions League ban for his social media comments after the defeat to Manchester United. Joachim says, if Gangon go down, how much Max, will you miss saying Gangon every week? Oh, don't worry. We can have a producer Jonathan. Can we have a Gangon section next season? No, he says.
You really enjoyed saying Ren.
I did.
Earlier,
yeah. Well, maybe
they could perhaps replace Gangon in your affections.
See, my French. I used to be quite good at French. I think out of the pod, I've got quite a good French accent. But something happens to me when I get in here. I can't help it. For some reason, producer Jonathan's saying, get on with this. Ben has given us a potential Gillingham team for the 1920 season of shithouses, Harlem Globetrotter shithouses I want to get together. Schmeichel, Lischteiner, Pepe Ramos, Godin, Chiellini, Catamol, Brown, Gabby Suarez, Costa, 5-3-2, Lischteiner and Chiellini providing the width. Is it possible to have too much shithouse? I would pay millions.
Is it Brown?
Scott Brown.
Oh, Scott Brown.
Yeah.
Which Schmeichel?
Well, it's got to be Casper, right? Is he the shithouser as keeper?
Is there no Jens Lehmann in this team?
Yeah. Well, I think he's retired.
I want mad Jens.
Funny enough, you know, in one of the social media things, I was looking through and I saw a headline from a few years ago where he sort of, and it was, he was, I think the younger Schmeichel was playing for Peterborough, and the headline was something that Casper has inherited his famous father's starfish. Which is obviously a reference to his...
What a lovely way to finish the pod, eh? Thanks for your time, John.
No problem at all.
Thank you, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Baz.
Thanks.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.